from Sports Pro. This is the Playbook Podcast with Matt Rogan.
Welcome to the Playbook Podcast, your fortnightly source of pragmatic advice for how to build better businesses in sports. Once again today, we're going to look slightly outside the business side of sport to gain some ideas and insight to take back into it. We're actually going to look at teaching sport in order to try and gain a better understanding of how the next generations understand and enjoy sport and how you can generate performance not only on the pitch but also in the classroom. My guest today is John Debman, Director of Sport and Co-Curricular Studies at Dr. Chandler's Grammar School, which he's led to recently being voted the best state school for sport in the UK for the very first time.
I'm getting a quote made for above my PE office, and I read this somewhere recently, and it says, "Success is something you attract by the person you become."
I went to Chandler's as a kid, and while we were always pretty decent, we were nowhere near the heights John's taken the school to. Within this pod, we didn't just look at how John's built up an organisation to perform, but we also spent a bit of time understanding how he's seen generations of students change over the years and asked what that means for the learning styles and attitudes to sport and business with those who are going to be joining our organisations in the next few years. As you'll hear, Dr. Chandler is traditionally an all-boys grammar school, which is now open to girls in the sixth form. We haven't got into the politics of school systems and grammars or not grammars here. Whatever your view, I think there's plenty here that you can all reflect on. Okay, well, John, thanks for coming on. Nice to see you.
You're welcome.
Firstly, and also please say thank you to the teacher who's standing in for you, so you could give us half an hour of your time today. So please pass thanks on from us to them as well. I guess to start off with, could you give us a bit of a sense of what Chandler's is all about? Tell us a bit about the school.
So Dr. Chandler's Grammar School, state grammar school in Buckinghamshire, one of five. It's 1,300 pupils. We're co-ed now in the sixth form, have been for 4 years. Leafy Buckinghamshire, town called Amersham, a cross-section of students, but generally a fairly affluent area. I've been here for 18 years as director of sport. When I came, it was a new position. The previous head was very pro sport, wanted to grow sport here. As I said, a huge then at the time boys school, crying out for lots of sport to happen. Three staff here when I began, and now we're up to six full-time PE staff, two PE assistants, a trainee, and about 16 non-PE staff that help run teams for us.
Awesome. And I guess, so my recollection of the school, being from having been through, is that pretty tight for space as well. So it might be leafy Buckinghamshire, but you use everything you can in terms of quite a tight bit of space that the school operates in, right?
Yes, so we have small fields which fits two football pitches or one football, one rugby, and a cricket square. We have an AstroTurf that was built 10 years ago now, which was desperately needed because the fields, as you know, drain pretty poorly in the winter. Eight tennis courts now. We're lucky we've got a Hervines Park next door to us, so we can use that for extra football or rugby pitches. And the best thing about that is the woods. We do a lot of cross-country here, so that area is fantastic for woods. But you're right, it's tucked into Amersham. There's not a lot of space for building projects within the school or out in the sports facilities either.
I've been blaming those pitches on my dodgy touch ever since, and that my dodgy first touch. okay, so maybe we could start with just, for those of us who are listening from overseas maybe, or even in the UK, tell us a bit about what it's like as a state school, state secondary school right now, because whether you're a grammar or a secondary or comprehensive, whatever you might be, you know, it's the same government budget lines ultimately that you're working with. And it, my perception is you've been trying to do more with less for a while now in terms of the amount of cash you have to work with.
Yes, I mean, we do get confused with an independent school, not quite sure why. As I say, there are only five state grammar schools in Bucks. But my philosophy, Matt, really always has been whatever facilities you get, whatever you're working with, you've got to maximise. And I think we've, as you said, we've managed to do more with less. We maximise facilities, staff facilities, resources, pitches, as we've already mentioned. And I mean, one thing that annoys me sometimes about other PE teachers is they say, "Oh, challengers, but you've got this, you've got that." But my philosophy, as I said, whether you've got three PE staff or six or 100, are they working as hard as us? Are they maximising the facilities? Are you giving the kids as much sporting experience as you can with what you've got? So that's really my philosophy. But things are tough. We mix it with the independent schools a lot in terms of fixtures. We have great respect for them. There's some fantastic schools that we play against. And we largely measure ourselves against them in, you know, in sport, but also the way we conduct ourselves, the respect we have for each other. The independent schools are fantastic at that. They're brilliant to play against because of the way they play the games, the mass fixtures that we get with them. And that really does boost our opportunities for our kids to play sport. And obviously, playing multiple games away from home, our coach budget is huge because we're always transporting A, B, C, D teams away. But we simply can't host those types of schools at home because we don't have the space.
And I guess following you, the school on Twitter, for example, what's striking is the amount of usage things like the AstroTurfs and things are getting. And I'm imagining that given the number of teams you run, getting discretionary effort from some of your teachers, you might be history teachers or geography teachers or whatever, by day, to be prepared to run teams and things is pretty fundamental to the way in which you're able to provide the scale of sport you do.
Yeah, I mean, we run about 100 teams in 13 different sports. And as I say, if you look at it bluntly with six PE teachers, it's never going to work. So, you know, you add to that a couple of PE assistants, lots of staff who, and remember, not being an independent school, they're not contracted to do any kind of extracurricular or co-curricular activities. So we have 15, 16 men and male and female staff that do a fantastic job. And my job as director of sport really is to create that culture, you know, of people wanting to do it, because they're fantastic characters and you get a lot out of them. And, you know, making them feel welcome. I always say, you give someone 10% and they'll give you 100% back. So looking after them, whether it's something as simple as giving them a North Face waterproof jacket to protect them in the winter, you know, you give them something like that, they're over the moon and they'll give you hours and hours of quality time back. So it all comes down again, as I said, to maximizing what you've got and looking after people. You've got to look after your team. It's part of not just my job as a leader, but my team of staff, that we are a team. And everyone gets looked after and everyone feels welcome and everyone wants to contribute.
It's interesting. It really reminds me of the kind of things that Paul Brown, who was CEO of Bol Foods, was talking about in an earlier podcast, in terms of how he was able to generate that discretionary time and effort from maybe people who are picking vegetables for him in the field, or people who are sort of in the factories and not able to be in kind of a nice, not that you're in a nice swanky office in HQ, but aren't in the sort of central London centre of things. So how you mentioned that there's been a real turnaround in terms of the school's commitment and resources it's put into sport. And you also mentioned that school sort of competes pretty well academically. So how do you have that conversation with a head teacher or a chair of governors? What's the point of sport in the school? You're really fundamentally, like, what do they view it gives the students? Is it about winning away at an independent school, or is it about something more fundamental?
It's definitely more fundamental than that. I mean, I was lucky when I came here that the head was very pro sport. And I often say to staff who are applying for other jobs, you know, one of the key things is the head. You know, who is the leader of that school? What do they want? Are they going to back you? And the previous head here and the current one are very pro sport. They both run cricket teams, for example. So and they've done that ever since they've been at the school. And I think nowadays, particularly with the last 12 months and COVID, there's even more emphasis and onus on us as PE teachers to give kids the activity and the sport. Because as an academic school, I mean, my philosophy is that most kids who come to Challoners, if they work hard, the teachers are fantastic, they're going to walk away with a set of GCSEs and a good set of A-levels. But that is half the story. You know, what else are they going to walk away from? I've just started my role as co-curricular director as well as sport. And I've read loads of articles about it. And one of them mentions the benefits of co-curricular activities in secondary sport. And one of them's better social skills, definitely improved academic performance. Now, that is one that's hard to drill into some parents. stress relief and relaxation, broadening your horizons, and ultimately university applications. And going back to parents, a little story from earlier this year, I had a year seven parent contact me in November and said, you know, I want Johnny to join the football club. And so I emailed back, well, it's been running for 7 weeks. Where's he been? Oh, we wanted him to settle into school and work on his homework for 7 weeks. And that to me, you know, it's not just disappointing. It's actually quite upsetting that that parents still have that perception that a pupil can come to a school like this and not think about that other 50%, you know, and they feel that they miss out so much. So I think the academic improvement is the key thing. As you know, you've got kids, I've got two teenage daughters. Ultimately, we want our kids to be happy. We want them to be confident. We want them to develop self-esteem. And if they can do those things, I know they work hard and they're going to get good academic results.
It's interesting, isn't it? If you look at the working environment, all the academic environment, what you notice happening when you take activity of any sort away from us is that purely focusing on the work creates quite unhappy bunnies. That's true of the, you know, the businesses where I've been a non-exec. It's true of you know, the school environment too. How have you managed, or have you managed to keep students engaging with activity somehow in a world where they're not coming into a central location every day?
Yeah, that's been hard. I mean, one thing we did do when we came back in September, I think we're one of the very few schools, certainly state schools around, we've done co-curricular activities for sport every single day since September, mm-hmm. apart from the 8-week lockdown recently. And that's been key. We wanted to get going as soon as possible. Again, the head was backing it. Again, something that annoys me a little bit is that I attended a district PE meeting in another district actually recently, and it was a bunch of people sat around a table making excuses for why they shouldn't be doing out of school sport. And it was so frustrating because we should be fighting for it. You know, unless you are fundamentally 100% told you cannot do it, just do it. And we've done that. During lockdown, it was Joe Wick style lessons. It was getting involved. As we both know, it's so hard when you're having a tough day to motivate yourself to do something and get your heart rate going. But if you can do it, we all know how great it makes you feel. We ran a girls yoga session for the sick form girls, and one of my young German teachers, she ran it for them. And I was drumming it into the girls. I was saying, you know, you're going to feel awesome after this. And those 30 or so, 30 out of 50 turned up for the first one.
Wow.
And the last thing we said at the end was, girls, well done. You are going to feel awesome for the rest of the day. And they did, you know. So it's tough. And when they're not at school, it's even tougher because, as I said, it's hard to motivate yourself. But certainly whilst they're in here, we do as much as we can for them.
Let's move on a little bit. So you're hiding your light under a bush a little bit because, so this year, next student, it was great to see Chandler's was the top state school in the country in terms of not culture, not the breadth of people playing, but at a kind of performance level, in terms of the performance of the top teams across the school, which is some turnaround when you are competing against the, you know, the independent schools up and down the country whose resources in terms of financial resources are, you know, pale into comparison. So how's that happened? You know, it's obviously been 18 years in the making, but so an 18 year flash in a pan, if you like. But what's made the biggest difference in terms of turning the whole organisation around to focus on sport, believe it's important, but also believe it's important to perform at the end of the day?
I think it's down to developing a culture. And I mean, a couple of things, as you've just said, we were voted or named the top state sporting school of 2020 by the National School Sport magazine. We came 8th overall out of 200 that were named, and the 7 above us were independent schools. Having said that, we had some national cross country and rugby successes recently, mm-hmm. but one thing I was very quick to point out was that I see that accolade as something that's been 18 years hard work. I would attribute it more to the sheer numbers of pupils that we are providing for, and you know, you've got to allow your top performers to excel, but you've also got to allow everybody else to enjoy sport and do as best as they can as well. So I've said to a lot of people, you know, next year we might come 200th on that list, but it doesn't mean we're still not doing a good job. I'll still be as proud next year. And one thing I've always said, I wrote a few articles for the National School Sport magazine a few years ago, and one of them was about mass participation and excellence. Mm-hmm. And I thought about calling it versus excellence, but then I just thought that they do go together so well. And a quote that I always say is that if you look after the masses, the trophies take care of themselves. And what I mean by that is you've got to promote numbers at a lower level, that the base of that pyramid has got to be as wide as possible to get kids involved from a very young age. My head of hockey tells a great story. He's had some fantastically talented hockey teams, and as a state school, we won the national indoor 5-6 years ago. We compete with the top independent schools, but he always says the strength of my hockey team is not the best three players, it's your number 9, 10, 11. Mm-hmm. We win games against players, teams with better individuals, because we might not have an England player like them, but our 9, 10, 11 players are stronger. And that resonates with me. You know, my daughter's been at school, both of them. And if you pick 16 girls in a netball team in year 7 only and discard the rest, by the time they get to year 9, 10, 11, sixth form, there are probably 4 left who want to play because they haven't built that base at the bottom. So it is really, as I say, creating that culture. And the other thing which I'm big on, as I mentioned earlier, is respect and resilience and just developing confidence and humility, and no arrogance whatsoever. There's no room for that. And just the success of a team. So as my PE team has been successful, you know, we do play as a team and there are no individuals. It's all about the team.
It's obviously a fantastic journey to be on, 17, 18 years in the making. I'm interested in where next, because unlike a professional sports team where you might, for example, have, you know, a few players changing in and out every year, you know, your first football 11, first netball 7, first rugby 15, once they get to university age, they're out of there. You've got to start again almost. So how do you think about reinventing the school sports teams every year? How do you think about that sort of responsibility to pass students on, and how do you then sit down with your teachers first thing in late August in next year and say, okay, well, we've got to go again?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, my view is always, I'm very forward thinking, strategically thinking. I love James Kerr's book, The Legacy, about the New Zealand All Blacks. And one of the chapters in there is entitled Go for the Gap. And he says, when you're at the top of your game, then change your game. I suppose my philosophy, going back to the mountain analogy that you mentioned, is if you reach the peak of a mountain, you're only looking down. So I look at it like that. I'm always going up that mountain. I'm always looking upwards. And you don't have time to celebrate and show off your successes, because I'm always looking at the best thing. So once, let's say, our celebration of sport evening every year, we do it in July. And on the way home from that with my wife, we sit down in a restaurant, have a meal. And the first thing I say is, right, what do I need to do better for next year? So within half an hour of that finishing, I'm already thinking of next year. And within an hour of it finishing, I've scribbled a few notes down. So that's my philosophy and what I want to embed in the students here. Another thing we've really focused on recently, with not just with COVID, but with the whole mental health thing, is developing leadership and amongst the kids. Our PE program here develops leadership opportunities for all students from year 7. So everything we do in lessons and co-curricular activities, we're trying to develop leadership. We're trying to develop, as I say, things like respect and humility and teamwork. So whilst if you measure it by trophies, as you say, it might never get better, but I measure success by every student at the school. And are those parents getting kids at 18 that have got all those other skills apart from the exam grades, which are going to come, I think, naturally if you work hard?
Yeah. Well, let's maybe move on to those students you're helping. And without making you sound, I think you're about the same age as me, so without making you sound too old, you know, you've seen a lot of different generations pass through in your teaching experience, either prior to Dr. Challoners or currently. What do you notice in the way that kids, I guess, are engaging with sport, how they play, how they relax, and how they unwind? Is that changing? And what have we got coming around the corner with the generations you're seeing maybe just starting secondary school now?
Yeah, I think you're right. It's and without me and you sitting here and saying, oh, back in our day we did this, you know, in the 18 years since I've been here, and even in the last 5-6 years, you notice a change. And as a leader, you need to embrace change because it's going to happen. There's no point being, you know, wanting it to be the same as it was 5 years ago. What I see now is, as you alluded to, there is less play, mm-hmm. in inverted commas. They want structure more. I think our top performers in schools are kind of becoming obsessed with the end product. They want the result rather than the process. They want to be a professional footballer. They want to be a gymnast. And they're forgetting the process that it takes to get to that, which can be a problem managing the expectations. I'm a big fan of, I've read articles about the importance of letting children do multi-sports or be specialists in many sports till the age of 16. And I certainly played all sports and obviously specialised in football eventually, but I was a county cricketer. I played tennis. I loved golf. I did everything, probably apart from rugby, actually, because it wasn't at my school. And I really believe you need to do that. And another sad thing that I've had in my whole time here at Challoners is great examples are the tennis players and the swimmers. Mm-hmm. And they get taken away at the age of 12. They get cut off from their social lives, from all other sports. And often, that particularly the tennis players are fantastically talented sportsmen. And they go for the 25 hours coaching a day. They want to leave school. They want to miss games lessons to have tennis coaching. The swimmers are getting up at 5 a.m. and they're obsessed. And with all respect, I'm trying to say to parents at the age of 12, you have not got the next Andy Murray. You have not got the next Michael Phelps. Let them play. Let them be good at everything. And at 16, if they still mentally got it, if your son or daughter still really wants to do it, they're not going to have lost out. So that's the thing I've noticed as a difference.
Sorry, is that about the parents wanting structure or the student, the kids wanting structure?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it's probably more parents, yeah, wanting, you know, they see the money in sport, particularly with football. And I don't think pupils know, you know, when they want to play, they need, I'm hoping we do it here, I'm sure we do, but they want that freedom to play and enjoy and be confident and lead. And we do give them that through team sports and through opportunities of individual sports. But going forward with COVID, I just see it even more important. And my worry for PE teachers, particularly in the state sector, mm-hmm. is they're going to be so in a rut and out of touch with doing co-curricular sport and fixtures. We're going to get to September and they're going to struggle to, you know, understandably, they're going to struggle mentally to actually get themselves out of that rut and continue the good work they were doing. The independent schools are brilliant. They've been brilliant all year and through lockdown. We have, but I do worry for 90% of the state school pupils when we do come out of COVID in September, hopefully fully, going forwards.
It's difficult, isn't it? Because as you say, you know, none of them, no state school teachers, I imagine in most countries around the world, have extracurricular or co-curricular things written into their contracts. And so, you know, if any of us get used to a world where, you know, the cricket team that I look after for my son's cricket club wasn't there really in 20 shape or form last year, and so I'm kind of a bit jittery about getting them back this year, and it's a bit difficult, you know, so I need somebody to to help me over that, over just getting into a different rut, and to help me understand the impact that I have on the overall cricketing experience of these kids, and just kind of play to my emotional sentiments as much as COVID has worked against them. Do you notice any differences in the way the perception would be, kids nowadays, said, getting very stereotypical, don't want to work hard, they're unable to focus, they'll play around with their phones more than they'll actually focus on working hard in sport or music or any other walk of life, or indeed their academics? Do you notice any of that, or do you think that's all just us old people not really getting them or understanding them?
I think it's hard to comprehend when we were brought up just before the advent of mobile phones. And as I said, the play, the free time we had, we did stuff, didn't we? We ran around and kicked a football. And so whilst moving with the times, I do understand that that's what they do now. They game, they go on their phones. I know from my daughters and the boys and girls that play sport here, though, I think the important thing is that what they do without their phones and when they do come to us, you know, they don't have phones and they're active and they enjoy it. And it's quality more than quantity. So I get a lot of parents who are worried about their pupils or their students rather, who spend too much time on their phone. Now, when I talk to, I'm a sixth form tutor. When I talk to them about revising for A-levels, I get them to make a plan of action, because you need a plan. If, as you know, even if you have a tick list of three things in a day you've got to accomplish, once you tick one of those off, it gives you that sense of accomplishment and it makes you feel good. So when I'm getting them to plan their day when they're revising, say they're on study leave, I say make a list. And I also say it's okay to have 50% of your time as recreation time. And if you want to watch a video, or you want to go for a walk with a friend, or you want to go on your phone for an hour, fantastic. If you then do an hour of maths homework and revision, even better. So you can't do 12 hours of work of written work and academic stuff. But ultimately as well, you can't do 12 hours a day of physical stuff. So whatever releases your mind from that, and it's about short bursts, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, and that includes on your phone. So I always get them to plan, and that they're surprised when I say this, plan your recreational time as well as your academic time.
So what would your hints and tips for those of us in the working world who'll be welcoming those young men and young women into our businesses in 2, 3, 4 years time, even sooner perhaps, what would your tips be for getting the mess out of them, sort of forget the 9 to 5 and talk to them about short sprints of effective working around the more balanced day? Is that kind of what you think they'll respond best to when they join our workforces?
Yeah, I think they want to. I'm massively into the sports psychology and stuff. And a word I love is confidence. And I've spoke about self-esteem for teenage kids as well now. And my team, you have to trust them, but I can't do everything for them. I mean, I think good leaders do three things. I call them the three L's. They learn. I mean, I'm always learning things about people I work with and things I do. Listen is a great thing as well, to be able to listen to people and looking, you know, I'm always looking beyond what I'm doing. And I think you need to get an efficient workforce. You need them to be confident and comfortable and trust them and really feel a part of your team, because then you get so much more productivity from them. If you try and micromanage, if you look over their shoulder, if they feel a little bit of lack of self-esteem, if they feel that they can't look at their phone in their break time because they're being watched, then it's gonna have an effect on them and their work quality and ultimately your business and your company. So I'd like to think the team I've got here are fantastic and they're confident. And when you've got brilliant individuals, you know, the old saying about the sum of the parts is the team. One brilliant quote, which you've seen at the school here, which I love about teamwork, is it's not the team with the best players that win, it's the players within the best team that wins. And it is just all about that, in my opinion.
So when, inevitably, when you have, say, new teachers join your team or a new member of staff of any sort, inevitably you have that conversation in your head that says, how much responsibility can I give them? How much flex can I give them? Because you can't just say, right, there's your job, crack on. Job's a good one.
Yeah.
So how do you handle that period of discomfort where you're thinking, have I given them enough rope? Have I given them too much? And how do you spot where you are on that continuum? And how often do you check in?
Yeah, that's a tricky one. And a lot of leadership is experience, as you will know. And one thing I do when recruiting's key, and I like to meet people in the world of PE teaching, but probably in the whole business world, you have a job description and you have an idea in your mind of a best fit, don't you? And people come and interview, and sometimes that goes completely out the window, because for our context, it might be, I really need someone to run a rugby team and be good at hockey. And you get a bunch of candidates in. And it goes out the window because I ultimately want someone that I like. And sometimes within 30 seconds, you can like or dislike somebody. I don't dislike many people at all, but I can really like someone by looking at them, by the way they engage initially. And so my view is getting the right people in. And then, as you say, giving them enough rope and being perceptive. But I think that word listening again as a leader is key. And just listening to the little things when they're talking to other people, looking at the way they behave, and just giving them that confidence. And sometimes giving confidence is letting them go, and you know what their skills and expertise is. And sometimes that confidence is saying, well done, or let me help you with this, or what do you think about that? So it's something that I'm always learning to deal with, but it is with experience. But I think the key answer to that is getting the right characters and personality in. And it's not always, I don't want anyone to be like me, because six of me in the department would be an absolute nightmare, because I'm terrible in some ways. But so I need different characters as well. And I always ask them, what personality are you going to bring to my team? And if they say they're like me, they're probably not going to get the job.
So you come to that conversation with your wife after the sport awards, and you're sat there thinking, have we as a school, sports department, have we had a good year? How do you evaluate a good year? Because I guess there's all sorts of things, from how well the senior teams have done, the volume of kids that have engaged with the sport, the general mental health in the school. You might have all sorts of different things. How do you evaluate, whether you're on budget, how do you evaluate all that? Like, how do you make sense of it all?
I don't worry too much about the budget. I'm always kept in check by the bursar here anyway. But I think, as I said, that it's mass participation. So yeah, look after the masses. The trophies take care of themselves. It's always nice to win the trophies. And I think a good year is getting as many pupils as possible doing things. How many boys have played C team fixtures? And I get as much joy out of, I've been at four national cross country winning events over last 10 years, actually. And I would always say, when your name's read out as the winning team in a national cross country event, that is awesome. And when you are out on the field with a bunch of D team cricketers, and one team South Africa and one team's Australia, and they're all your boys, and half of them can't bowl properly, and at the end when they leave and they say, thanks, sir, that was brilliant, and the look on their face genuinely, that's awesome as well. So it's kind of everything, really. And looking at sitting back at that celebration of sport evening and looking at the parents, looking at the staff, and just looking how proud everyone is of the school, you can just sort of quietly slip away and think, yeah, that's brilliant. And I mean, one of my quotes on the board downstairs about leadership is that good leaders do what is right when no one is watching. And I always say this, that if you were to walk in my PE office and there were seven or eight of us in there, you should have no idea whatsoever who's in charge. You know, you should walk into an environment where there are six or seven brilliant individuals and you have no idea that I'm the leader. You know, I haven't got any badges on my back or director of sport this, but everyone in there is part of one team, and that's it.
Just a few more grey hairs maybe, but we'll cover that later. So how you mentioned that you've been co-ed for 4 years. Maybe the last area I wanted to explore was whether your philosophy or the teachers you brought in or just your general approach, how it changed and evolved to recognise that sixth form, it was a co-ed school. Because a lot of sports, professional and participation, that are finally having to wake up to this area of gender balance. So what did you learn through that we might be able to take something from?
Yeah, we did a lot of work here prior to the girls coming in. I've got a bit of a head start because I've got two teenage daughters who are now 20 and 17. My eldest came here, Esme came here for 2 years and left 2 years ago, and she's very sporty. So we did a lot of work as a school. And within sport, again, I say this to a lot of PE, heads of PE, you've got to pick your strengths. So we thought, what can we do with the girls which is going to get lots of participation and we can do? So we chose netball. And on top of that, we offered badminton and yoga to the girls. So they have compulsory games on a Wednesday afternoon with the boys. We wanted initially to get that netball team, and that was important. The brilliant thing, again, talking about success, is that we have A, B and sometimes C netball teams. And I would say out of the girls that play netball, 30-40% say to me, I've never played netball before.
Wow.
They've been at another secondary school, state school, for 5 years, and they were one of those girls discarded in year seven because they weren't in the best seven players. Mm-hmm. And they come to us, I've never played netball before. We don't care. Come and play. And they absolutely love it. And they get 2 years of brilliant team sport. And I'm reading so many articles at the moment about teenage girls, the percentage of dropouts from the during puberty, so between the age of 11 and 16, which is sad. And in a way, we're getting them at 16, but I'm hoping to reverse that. We're getting more involved. Mixed sport's important as well for the boys and the girls. We do tomorrow afternoon, we've got a mixed netball for the year 12s, and we've got a mixed softball tournament for the year 13s. And I spoke to the school head boy earlier, and I just said, look, Dan, I want as many boys and girls out on that field in the sunshine tomorrow afternoon as possible, having fun, and it's going to be brilliant. So, we've got a really important job, and I think we've managed that really, really well with the girls here.
And so, final question then. You talked about your role now is effectively to take the amazing journey you've been through in sport, and then take that into some other kind of areas of the curriculum. So if I asked you to sum up in a nutshell what your secret sauce is that you're going to be taking out to the other bits of the school co-curricular area, what is it? How would you sum it up?
I'm getting a quote made for above my PE office, and I read this somewhere recently, and it says, success is something you attract by the person you become. And that sums up for me that your success as an individual is nothing really to do with how many A-levels and GCSEs you've got. It's that person that you become. So my role as co-curricular director now is to instill, what type of person can you become, whether you're musical, whether you're a dramatist, whether you like art, whether you play chess, and hopefully doing something physically active as well is getting that message out to not just the students, but the parents as well. So I'm trying to bring what we've done in sport to everything else co-curricular within the school, and just create, again, I've spoken about culture a lot, the culture and the confidence of pupils to just want to get out there and do something. Don't go home at 3:30 and sit in front of the TV. Particularly now we've got 4 or 5 hours of daylight when you finish school. So get out and do something. And I know it's probably never going to happen, but my ultimate goal will be to have 180 boys in a certain year group staying after school to do something every night. But that's not quite going to happen, but it's what we're going to aspire to here.
Fantastic. Okay, let's just repeat that line. Success is something you attract by the person you become. That's fantastic. And I normally ask people at the end of the podcast to sum up their core message from the show in 10 words or less, and fortuitously that's exactly 10, so you get away without having to do that tough question at the end. So John, that's been fantastic. Thank you ever so much for your time. There's definitely something we can all empathize with schools. Of course, it's an industry. If it's an industry, we all know very well, so hopefully there's something for everyone in there. If people want to get hold of you or get in touch or just offer some feedback, what's the best place to get hold of you?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm on LinkedIn, and my email address is jde@challoners.org. So look me up at Dr. Challoners Grammar School. Look me up on LinkedIn. I'll be happy to talk to people, and I learn from people as well. So if someone wants to know something from me, I'll probably end up picking up more information from them. So it'd be great to talk.
I can definitely empathise with that. Thanks ever so much for your time.
Cheers, Matt.
The Playbook podcast is published by SportsPro and is part of a wider series delivering agenda-free, pragmatic advice on how to navigate your organisation through change. To explore the library and find out about the Playbook Lab's Residential Executive Training Programme, head to sportspromedia.com/playbook.